Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
I'm Amira.
I'm JW.
And we got to send a big thank you to all of our supporters who have supported us as many ways to do it. Patreon, iTunes reviews, sharing on social media. We got some heavy shares recently from Hunter Malone. We have Doug Rice pushing us, giving us a lot of love on Twitter. So on Facebook, we had Lola Renee and Chavez Taylor. I mean, I'm saying government names now, but please forgive me. Thank y'all so much for supporting us, sharing the podcast, and just supporting in general. It helps people find out about what we're doing here. If you like it, share it, tell your friends. Shares help. Reviews help. All of it helps. The Patreon definitely helps, but, you know, just getting the word out about what we're doing here. We're doing it for y'all, so.
We appreciate it.
So this week, we're asking the question, what keeps the church from apologizing for harm?
Ooh.
Now, there's a lot of harm committed by the church. We know this. We've discussed this on the show. We talk about atonement a lot. But honestly, the church has a lot to atone for. And I think part of that atonement is actually looking inward to see where we may have gone down the wrong path.
Yeah, you would hope that we would start to look inward, right? I'm not so sure that we're always willing to do that.
Right.
And I think that is evidenced probably by the lack of a corporate apology or a stance, or just an understanding, right, that harm has been committed. And so I don't know how willing the church is to do it. There are pockets of it. There are individual churches and there are people who will do it. But the church on a corporate level, I don't know that I see it. Maybe as much as what is really necessary.
See, I think part of the problem is the church is made up of a collection of people. And those people collectively are bad at atoning or at least acknowledging some of the things that they do wrong. So, like, you got, you know, people who have secrets and hide things. And this is just one of the things that we as humans are good at doing. And I think once you get a group of those people together, and you're in this situation where collectively, maybe we're not the best at this. Like, I remember, maybe I shouldn't tell the story, but it's a podcast. Who cares? We're going to tell it anyway. All right, so I'm younger, like a teenager, you know, excited about teenage boy stuff and, you know, discovering things. And so during one of those times when you starting to discover some of those stores you could go to and things like that.
Right. Shout out to Blockbuster. Arrows, everybody.
It's like, Arrows video.
You feel
with
it,
the,
don't you?
the wood panel walls. So you go to the, I remember one time I went to the back. It's real creepy back there. You know, it's not well lit.
It was about nature.
The tape was about nature.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I saw that one.
Yeah. So I go get this tape, right? I got the thing, and, you know, you're waiting for the right time. You know, the house is empty. You get it. You watch it. And then you do what you do. So if it's good enough, gets the job done. You know what I'm saying? So anyway, so after the job is done, you start to feel guilty about this. I mean, I'm a young man in church and youth ministry and stuff like that. So, I mean, this is kind of like, you know, a lot of guilt associated with this. I shouldn't be doing this, you know, but that never happens. Like, during that always happens, like, after. Like, I never feel like I should be doing this when I get the black plastic bag.
It's like, I'm doing it.
So, anyway. Mm-hmm. So, it's over and I'm like, I got to get rid of this thing. I'm horrible. You know, I'm promising God all kinds of things. So, I pull the tape out. It's a VCR. This is old. I take it out the spool.
Right.
And then I take it out to the backyard. And I toss. It's like it's a tree line in the back. And so I kind of just toss it in the back. I got a good arm. So I'm tossing it in the back of the woods. And I'm like, God, I'm not doing this no more. So a week went by. And I was like, you know what? That tape wasn't that bad. It was actually, I mean, I spent my money on it. So I go back, and so now this is like a week later, and I threw it real deep into the woods. It had rained by this time. So anyway, I go out to the woods, and I'm walking in the woods searching for this tape that's all wet now, and just, I'm looking everywhere. This is out of control. So I find the tape. I re-spool the tape. Get it back into house. It actually works. It worked on many levels. So the level that I went through to hide this thing, like, nobody's in the house. It's not like I'm just like, Dad, I'm going outside looking for this tape. You know, I got to wait for everyone, the house to clear out, time to be right. It's just a whole lot of, I don't know why I'm telling this story. It's just, anyway, we have something in us that,
yeah,
that kind of prompts us to hide things that we may be ashamed of. And
right.
It ends up like compounding once you get into a space with other people who are good at this thing. So why do you think we do that?
I think people do that. If, like, per your example, the emergence of any type of guilt or shame feeling means that someone has planted within you that the action or the indulgence was wrong in the first place. So, because without the presence of that knowledge, I don't think you have such a, you know, shameful or guilty reaction to something that you do in private. But I mean, I think we do certain things as far as covering, as far as keeping things to ourselves. On the one hand, sometimes people are really private, but on the other hand, sometimes people have already been shamed, and that stops them from being open.
Yeah, I think that whole process, though, is set up to shame you. I mean, just if you just look at it, you in the back of the store, it's a curtain, you know, it's creepy dudes right, back there, it's all type of, you know, like I said, the lightning is poor. It's not like you want the salesman running up to you like in the furniture store.
We're so twisted up about sex and sexual expression, you know, whether you look at that through a religious framework or not, like, if you keep up with like world perspective, you know, how other countries perceive your culture and how you perceive other countries' culture. Sure. There are a number of like European countries that feel like America is just twisted up about sex and sexual expression. Add to that mix the layer of sometimes toxic information about private things. So private things, including, you know, sex and sexual expression. And I just feel like people have decided that these are two different realities that they have to navigate. Who I am privately, who I am publicly, and it follows us no matter what organization we're representing at the time. So when you're in church, naturally, people are whoever they are privately, kind of out with their representative, who they, you know, behave as publicly. And then in that environment, people are telling you what's right and what's wrong. So what if your private stuff all lines up on the wrong?
So I think I've said this before, to your point, in church. On Sundays, what happens is people, at least used to, you'd come to church with your Sunday best on, right? And so that wasn't just a literal come to church with your one good suit, your red tie or whatever, and that was it. Like, that was your everyday. Your red, maybe a black tie or something, right? Like, that's everything you had. That was the outward appearance, but it wasn't just that. What also used to happen and still happens is that's a bunch of families who would come in and they would say, I'm going to now put on my Sunday best. That means when we get here, don't act up.
Yeah.
Don't ask for nothing. Don't do nothing. Don't run. Don't look. Don't smile. Don't laugh. Don't cry. You got a lot of don'ts. So by the time you sit down in church, you're now holding everything in. Why? Because you're taught that's house business. We don't discuss house business out there in the street with everybody else.
I do think
so. House business is not just the negative implications of sex. It goes to a whole bunch of things, to include, listen, domestic violence and a whole bunch of issues that
gambling,
would happen, right?
Drug abuse,
all of that. And all of that stuff was in one family. But when that one family is in their house, oh man, to hell with it. We're going to say everything. When we get to church, when you go to the park, to the school, you are taught, hold all that back.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So you're taught in some sense to do it on an individual family basis. When you come together corporately, that's just a bunch of families all holding things back.
But I feel like some of the behavior is going to follow the individual. So you have families that don't communicate that well, where even if they are behind closed doors and now it's just, you know, the people directly affected by what's going on in the house, it's not like they're sitting there talking about the domestic violence incident.
True.
There's more so a feeling of threat, like, don't mention it outside. So there's no stage or no audience for working out more conflict-based type of interactions, feelings, or things. So when we get to church, sometimes we're dealing with people who have mastered the art of covering things up, mm-hmm. or they're making it so that that becomes the skill set that they pass on. They're mm-hmm. not trying to fix that within themselves. So they end up showing people a more negative way to cope with bad information or conflict.
So I see that some of this is passed on, some of this is learned behavior, but in some cases, I wonder, when do we learn this? Because my kids seem to already know this mm-hmm. without being taught. So like, I went up in my son's room and I'm looking for something. And I found all these candy wrappers and I'm like, yo, where? First of all, I'm telling this business, but he's young. He doesn't listen to this podcast. He's not going for a few years at least. So I came downstairs and same thing, like we had a box of Pop-Tarts and I was like, yo, why are the Pop-Tarts disappearing? I look in his bag, he got $3 worth of Pop-Tarts in his bag, and I'm like, yo, why are you, we never said you could only have one Pop-Tart. Why do you feel like you need to hide and take more to school? I don't know if you're feeding your friends or you're feeding yourself. It can't be feeding. I swear, yo, we feed our child. Don't call CPS. But like, we do take care of him. But it's just one of them things on his own, he knew how to do. And he never planned on telling me about this. So thinking back to what you said, JW, I'm trying to figure out if this is house business or church business, mm-hmm. however we want to describe this. It doesn't seem like the person's doing this or the person's involved ever want to come back to handle the business. Like, it's not house business. It's business that you never really want to discuss. So you don't want to talk about.
Of course.
So if in fact it is house business, it can't be a situation where that business is never handled.
Okay. But I don't think that is unique to the church.
Correct.
No.
That's okay. People. Because that goes to the point you were just making, right? Even in the house, whatever the issue is, there's still a whole lot that we still to this day, we just don't talk about. Mm-hmm. Even in my family, there are issues right now that things that happen in childhood, we don't speak it out.
So I feel like a part of what has been a long range healing journey for me was when I was just thinking about these coping skills or these covering skills. And I said, okay, but I'm one person. Mm-hmm. So I'm the same person regardless of whether I'm in public, where you can be around a lot of people and still be anonymous. You know, think about a busy street sidewalk. Nobody knows you're there, yet y'all are all there. And it's like, sometimes I think about that. That's the collision of like hundreds of lives just traveling up and down the street. It's not that, it's very simple. It's very mundane, but it's amazing for real,
right?
You know, to exist that way. But I'm going to be the same person that is on that street that is also in private, you know, journaling, trying to figure some things out. I'm going to be the same person at work. And when I try, you know, around my friends, even when I try to reconcile all of those different representations of me, it did help me uncover some things, because it was like, why are you covering that up? Why do you feel like you need to present differently? Now, some things just make some sense, you know, like your code switch or, you know, being professional in a professional environment or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that some people have made up in their mind that they are different people, not like multiple personalities, but just think about it. Like, I am my role, right? We had this conversation about mothers. Mothers are women. You weren't born a mother. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like, it's almost like if you humanize what might be the negative behavior, some people feel like they're giving up it's like a power shift. Because if you don't think that they're perfect in that area, how can they demand perfection from somebody else? It's very human. I don't think these things happen germane to the church.
This is a very much a human problem, to your mm-hmm. point. But what you just said, though, Amira, is you were ready to do the work to try to figure some things out.
Oh, yeah.
To fix some things that may have been covered up. Every individual kind of has to come to that point, right? Because if you don't come to that point, then I'm going to go back to the earlier example. We're going to go right back to mm-hmm. now being in some corporate body, corporate mm-hmm. family body, church, organization, you know, fraternity, sorority, whatever, mm-hmm. where what are we going to do? Still start covering up because we haven't done the work to fix some of these kind of pre-existing issues.
And not only that, but people just don't have the concept of like humility. You know what I mean? Like sometimes it takes, especially to offer apology, to look back over your behavior or whatever and offer apology, you would have to humble yourself.
Yeah.
Now, if we're talking about humbling mega churches, you know, where the shepherd might be stepping on toes, and some people are, you know, rooting for that because they're like, tell it how it is. But on the other hand, you do have people who are experiencing true harm, true pain, true damage. It's that much more hard to humble somebody like a family member, a friend who owes you that apology. It might, like, you will have difficulty
right.
trying to get that out of an organization.
There was an article recently, but I'm pretty sure I've been involved in churches like this, where it was a multicultural church, mm-hmm. and there was the minority, the African-Americans in the church, were trying to describe some of the racist behaviors that they've witnessed, not just in the community,
but also in
the church. Mm-hmm. And when somebody in the church leadership responds to it, their response is, well, see, we can't always keep talking about racism. See, if we keep talking about it, see, you're going to keep stirring things up, and we're never going to be able to move beyond this. Yeah. So why don't we just focus on the love part and let's forget about the racism,
not realizing
the words that just came out of their mouth are further exacerbating the issue, but they didn't comprehend it. Right.
For people who don't feel racism is a daily part of the experience. I mean, they're uncomfortable when it comes up.
Sure.
And it's ugly.
Yeah.
It gets to the point where the descriptions are downright ugly.
So what do we do then with the ugliness? Right. Let's hide that. We cover that up. We don't need to deal with it.
Because of the discomfort that it causes you. Yeah, because of the, I mean, so imagine this, you know, I can definitely see talking about personal things, the domestic violence incident, the sexual violence incident, the personal finance, you know, significant loss. Those things might bring embarrassment feelings, you know, they bring feelings up to the surface. But I just think that, you know, when we say that the church needs to be able to open itself to giving advice that includes professional feedback from the mental health community or something, right? So when somebody comes to you with something very significant, one, if you can't acknowledge where your abilities end and begin, like, and this has nothing to do with the all healing, all powerful, you know, all present God. This has to do with, are you a mental health counselor? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Are you a personal finance advisor?
Right.
Are you a family therapist? You know, if that is not where your training lies, you have to try not to do that work because you can make the wound worse.
Absolutely.
But it might not always be something like that, but you can make the wound worse trying to be something that you're not.
So speaking of making the wound worse, I think that's also an issue that we see a lot in the church. It's because you have somebody who is not skilled in mental health and how to counsel and how to work with and how to prescribe or describe what's happening. And so what do? We use churchism. What are the churchisms to do? To acknowledge the fact that we're ignorant of it. And the churchism also says, I get to kind of sweep this and keep it moving because I will put it into the bucket of, well, just pray to an all-powerful, all-seeing, all-knowing God, and he will take care of it. I'm not negating the value of the statement, but what happens is you've just short-circuited all of the work that needs to happen here on earth to deal with whatever it is. If you've been abused in any way, and all the answer is, well, just pray about it. All right, let's move on to the next topic. Mm. Right? That's harmful, man. Like that's a harmful thing to do. I think a lot of churches find themselves there because people, instead of learning to just be silent and to say, I don't know, and you should go talk to somebody, we try to solve it.
All right. The way I understand this is churches are made up of people. Mm-hmm. And within this church, there's a collection of people who are collectively bad at assessing, acknowledging, and addressing some of these things that we're ashamed of. And we've been so bad at this for so long, we aren't equipped to do this collectively. So we take all of those deficiencies and sum them up, and we just have this collective issue as a church where we, as now a body, are bad at assessing, acknowledging, and addressing some of these shortcomings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, for instance, you take something like slavery, which the church is complicit in propelling in this country as a means of economic development. And they used the Bible to promote slavery to obtain this free labor by cherry picking scriptures from the Bible and constructing something to give to
this belief system.
Right, this belief system to give to these slaves to maintain order and keep that economic engine going. And so the church knows that, that it's played its part in this. But the church has never come back to address this, to own up to this. And so not being yet to do something that's so obvious, it shows how bad we are at addressing
this. Okay, so this is a perfect time to just connect the dots, though, because we've had the conversation previously that nothing is going to happen in the church that doesn't happen in the community. So the community writ large has the same problem mm-hmm. of acknowledging verifiable offense done to whole groups in the name of whatever the institution is. As long as the community struggles with that and obscures how much they contribute to the discomfort or the disenfranchisement or the danger of other communities. As long as we struggle with that, you're not going to see that be any different in the church.
Okay, so who goes first? Is it the community or the church?
I mean, I think we are going first, but to further connect the dots, we're up against the same structural barriers. So if we talk about racism and white supremacy being a structural barrier in the community, it's going to be a structural barrier within the institution. If we talk about patriarchy being a structural barrier, if we talk about, you know, aggressive heteronormatism being a structural barrier, it's going to be that in both places. So you say who goes first? I think it's really like who's going to go the hardest. The okay. church has not positioned itself to take itself off this perch that it directly benefits from keeping some of these structures set up. The church, you understand what I'm saying? Like,
I guess I just feel like the church has a specific responsibility in terms of its contribution to the structural systems of oppression that are currently in place.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there are things that are used out of this particular holy book that are used to oppress women, the LGBTQIA community, people of color. Immigrant Sessions just tried to use the Bible to justify what they're doing with these children at the border. So at the point when we're saying we're using these set of mm-hmm. scriptures from this book to oppress this specific way, yes, there are things that are in the community that we handle, but these things are right. from a religious standpoint. So it's not like we're talking about like redlining or thing like policies that went into place overtly, because we know that the church kind of so I'm talking about things that can be directly attributed right. to the use of this specific religious text. I think that's fair.
It is fair. But this goes back to where we started this conversation about you got to start with the individual. So I think the biggest way that the church, the corporate church, I'm using air quotes, the corporate church can resolve this is it's going to take individual churches and then individuals within those churches taking a stand to go, you know what? We kind of screwed this up.
Right.
And so we got to repent and try to fix this one particular thing. Like, it's easy to sit back and to go, okay, this church struggles with racism. This one and that one has a patriarchal issue, right? And this one has a financial issue of robbing the community of its resources and taking these and not using them back. Cool. Those are the issues. Then those churches have to go back and fix
that work.
Do that mm-hmm. work, fix that thing. There are churches out there who are trying to do that work. Mm-hmm. But the problem, so to speak, is there are not enough churches, as you said, Amir, owning up for what they did wrong and then doing that individual work as a church to go, here's where we screwed up.
Right.
You got to know that you're wrong, though. And that's not the easiest thing. That's not always apparent. That's what's difficult. I mean, you don't always know when you are wrong. You may have these blind spots.
I'm challenging that. Nope. You do.
Okay, go ahead.
You do. Your son knew when he took the Pop-Tarts. Where were the Pop-Tarts? Just laying on the bed?
No.
You know innately when you do something wrong. When my sons in the car used to say, hey, Daddy, what's the speed limit on this road? It's 55. Why are you asking? How fast you going?
Ooh.
I'm going 75. Joker, what you asking for? Doesn't that mean that you breaking the law? Yeah. So because he led me through the whole question, the next time he said, what's the speed limit? Already, I can feel on the inside of me an answer welling up that I'm trying not to break him down with. So then I would go, why? No, Dad, I'm just saying, what's the speed limit? You know, I didn't see it. I didn't see the sign. This is at 4. Every time he's in the car, now he's sitting beside me and I go over 55. Or excuse me, not beside me. He was behind at that point in the back seat. But he could see the speed limit. He's asking me the question. He knows. But I could see him in the rearview mirror and I'm like, here it comes. Nobody has to tell me I'm wrong. I won't openly talk about the fact that I might have an issue when it comes to driving. But it's known in my family. That's why I'm just saying, no, you know it's wrong.
I don't disagree with that for the example that you used. Yeah. But let's take a different example. Let's say someone is pointing out to, let's say a guy is pointing out to another guy, you know, in reference to how he's treating a woman. You can say, hey, that behavior is not the right behavior. And you may have been raised like that, you know, fathers, you know, uncles, whatever. But here's why that's wrong. That is not something that's innate. Like, just like we talked about in the queer theology episode, we could say to someone in the church saying, hey, listen, the way that you're applying those scriptures, the way you're interpreting them, that's not the right way. Mm-hmm. But until someone points that out, you think that you're on the right path. And that's what I mean when I say you have to know that you're doing wrong. Sometimes you may need to point it out to you. Collectively, this nation is waking up to the reality that there's a lot of blind spots that we didn't know. I mean, specifically with, in a lot of cases, men and how we treat women. I mean, that street harassment, some guys don't really understand that they're wrong.
Oh, sure.
Or some guys don't know how wrong they are.
I have a sister who lives in Atlanta, and years ago, just to show you how screwed up my thinking was, in a discussion one day, I don't remember what it was. So in a discussion one day, we were talking about a church and their belief about women in the pulpit. Mm-hmm. And I said what I thought was a decent statement, but I was a teenager. So I kind of thought I knew a whole lot, but didn't. And she's older than me. And I was like, see, I just think that's so backwards. I said, that thinking doesn't make sense. And she was like, I know. Isn't that crazy? I said, yeah, because doesn't the scripture talk about, you know, God can use anybody. So I'm saying if he's going to use a donkey, I'm saying he could use anybody.
Oh, my.
And I assure you, I thought that she was going to slap the black off me while sitting there.
Hold up. Time out. In your analogy, who's the donkey?
Well, probably I would. If this were the Breakfast Club, I'd get the Donkey of the Day award. But my point is the example I used was pitiful.
Right.
And to your point, she had to help me understand how stupid my thinking was.
Your choice of
so
language.
I didn't realize that. So you're right. I didn't actually realize that. But ever since she said that, oh, it didn't take long. Oh, it didn't take long to go, all right, I got to watch what I'm, you know, how am I thinking? Like, how did I arrive at this perspective? Because that challenged me in that example to relook at a whole bunch of things. So you're right. You're right. I give you that.
Yeah. And there's a progression there, too. I mean, like even in the example that you used, JW, I mean, there's the point when you go from I don't want to say the wrong thing to graduating to I don't want to think the wrong thing.
Right. Absolutely.
So I think there's like a lot of growth there. And I think with regard to this harm that's caused by this collective of individuals that, OK, once we get through the assessment and we can acknowledge that we have harmed all of these people groups for whatever reason. I mean, people, we intentional or unintentional, we do harm. And so you can't always stop that. You can minimize it. But once you get to that point where you understand what you've done,
right,
that addressing is so critical because you have to figure out, okay, how can I circle back now and make this community, this person whole? When it was my actions or our actions that led to this fracture. So when I see churches or faith organizations stop short of that type of not just reconciliation, but restoration of something that was taken or something that was robbed of a group or like that piece needs to to happen, and is I don't see that happening enough.
Right, because I think that you at some point when you're asking somebody not only to acknowledge the harm that they've done, but then to apologize for it, and then I would presume conduct themselves differently depending on who you're sharing that expectation with or that requirement of behavior with. You're asking them to concede authority, power, influence. You're asking them to come down almost to a peer level that maybe they don't see themselves. So sometimes acknowledging that you're right or wrong would have to be also acknowledging that you can be wrong at your level of whatever, you know, however you interacted with the situation. So sometimes, yeah, it is kind of difficult for women to get an apology from men for certain things, whether it be their choice of language or their behavior in a situation or anything. It could be difficult the other way around, but we might perceive it to be a little bit more difficult because of the different ways we interact with men in different organizations where that communication can be difficult, especially if he doesn't see himself as her peer, regardless of their titles, right? Ultimately, you have some men who are like, that's a woman. She can't talk to me like that. Or I don't have to say I'm sorry or whatever. As long as you have that happening between individuals, no matter where those individuals happen to be, it's going to happen. You get into environments where you can form groups around common perspective. And if that's the common perspective, that no matter what, you know, the man comes first, the woman comes second, she's always going to be beneath him.
Right.
You're never going to be able to exact or turn about and gain that behavioral change because that's not how they have been trained to interact. It's going to be the same way with, you know, if I'm heterosexual and I feel like this is the absolute only way to exist, you know, and be in God's favor, you're not going to turn that.
So how do we take that first step then? Or what are the series of steps or what? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's just important for those organizations that have to be honest about where they fall in the pecking order, have to be serious about healing at their level and where they think is behind them. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a progressive, at least in my mind, if you have a progressive leadership structure or you have any sort of progressive type of, let's say, making people whole, seeing people as who they are, if that's coming out of your pulpit and the leadership is strong, you have to be really, really intentional about making sure that that resonates with individuals. And that resonates across ministries, that your ministerial leaders are carrying that banner. Because what if that's the only real way that those members interact with the church? You see what I mean? Like if I'm singing in the choir, I don't want to sing under a choir director who's saying something different that might be tearing me down personally that my pastor's not saying. My pastor needs to be aware of, you know, who's carrying his banner in different ministries. And I would just think that if you do that work where you are, then hopefully you can in turn have other ministries doing that with you. You know, the larger ones to the smaller ones, or, you know, the more white congregations with more black or more minority people of color congregations or whatever. I just think we got to be serious about making people whole in as tight a group as possible. And then you multiply that out.
Right.
So I do need to take a moment to acknowledge the difficulty that a leader or a pastor has in making some of these large course corrections or steering that rudder to move that ship in a different direction. So we saw this what happened with Carlton Pearson, where he wanted to actually do something completely different and how that impacted him and those people around him. So I think about it like I was a kid and my sister and I, we're in the car with my parents. This wouldn't happen now because we have GPS. But during those times where you actually had to know where you were going, there were times where we would maybe end up lost. And so my sister and I would be in the back seat like, you know, Daddy, what's going on? Are we lost? And he's like, wait, stop talking. Like it's real, like real abrupt. And he's feeling responsible for all of the people in that car. He's responsible for taking all of us somewhere. So his first response to being questioned about are we on the wrong road, it's he's not really ready to acknowledge that. I do understand that difficulty because there's a huge weight there. The people who are outside of that leadership position do not always understand how much of a weight that is to know that if I go this way, I'm losing a lot. I'm hurting a lot of people. I'm doing these things. Like it's a difficult position to be in. So in that situation, yeah, my father, he has to at some point acknowledge mm-hmm. that we're on the wrong road in order for us to get on the right road. But he eventually has to turn down the right road.
I'll add to it by saying it is also possible to be taught not to apologize, right? That as a leader, you can't actually say that you're wrong because then that in and of itself would be a sign of weakness. Now, we know that's not true, but there are people that are legitimately taught that way. When I first left government service, went into consulting at this very large consulting firm, I made a mistake. And I remember the first thing I said in the email was, I'm sorry. And then I went on to talk about all these other things. Well, this person, a little more senior to me, she calls me into her office and she says, listen to me. Mm-hmm. Everything you've done so far is fine, but you made one mistake. I said, mm-hmm. what's the mistake? I said, well, I know. I said, I was sorry. That's your mistake. Don't ever start. Yeah. Don't ever tell anybody that you're sorry. Yeah. Just mm-hmm. fix it. Move on, but you don't ever acknowledge being sorry. And I remember sitting there and this thing tripped me out to no end because I went, did you just say that? Like, don't apologize. Like, I don't even understand it. But when I tell you she meant that, no, she meant that. And so that happens in a whole lot of different industries, to include in the pastorate. Because again, growing up in church, having family in church, there are churches that I'm aware of that they would literally be like, no, don't come out and say that you're sorry. Now, if we need to make a change, we'll make a change. But just because you did X, don't worry about that. Keep on stepping. So to your point, Mike, it can be hard, but it can also be possible that some people are taught, that's a sign of weakness. And as a leader, you can't be weak. So again, I'm not excusing it. I'm with you. We do have to give some bit of latitude and grace, if you will, so to speak, to use the churchism of it. We do have to give latitude to understand that it's not easy. But I guess what I would say is, now we got to do the work, man. We got to do the work.
Just like you can be taught not to apologize, you can be taught to apologize. So like, again, I feel like equipping people with the skill set to be able to communicate around difficult things will transcend. That could be something that comes across like a Sunday school or a Bible study or something. But really what you're trying to do is plant seeds, because if I get you communicating better, you know, with your friends, with your family, in certain role relationships, then that can be amplified, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're teaching married couples how to fight fair and how to use apologies as tools, mm-hmm. right? Then imagine taking those tools to work, because sometimes situations happen and you're like, this reminds me of, you know, the whole he won't pick his socks up, you know, situation. So you now have a skill set that is transferable. You can be taught anything. Just because you've been taught to be, you know, a jerk doesn't mm-hmm. mean that you can't learn a new way. It always will come down to will. Not really ability. I think it's just your will.
And so we acknowledge that this is a difficult thing. When you cause harm, it's difficult to admit that. It's difficult to see that sometimes. It's difficult to deal with that. Sometimes the shame that comes with it, it's almost an unbearable burden. But I guarantee you it's less of a burden than the person who you harmed is dealing with. So it's important that we actually can take that step of facing that, and then and understanding that we did that, admitting it, and then actually making the effort to address it. David said in Psalms 32:5, he said, I acknowledge my sin to you, and I did not cover my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that the psalmist knew, and something that we have the ability to do when we found ourselves in that position. Just acknowledge that. And that shame is a real thing, but you will live. It's important to come back and restore that thing that was broken. So we've covered a lot of examples today as we're trying to go through this, but we kind of steer clear of one because we're going to be discussing that in greater detail next week on that episode regarding sexual assault and sexual violence in our Church 2 episode. So we hope you come back and see us next week. Thank you for staying with us this week. For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
I'm Amira.
I'm JW.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.